We are not cops ranging over the realm of social media and solving the world's ills. Our sole job is to hold this extremely powerful corporation, Facebook, accountable for making clear, consistent, and transparent decisions.
On Wednesday, Facebook's oversight board ruled to uphold the social network's suspension of former President Donald Trump with a few important caveats. You might remember that Facebook kicked him off the platform earlier this year following his incitement of the January 6th storming of the Capitol. The Facebook Oversight Board is an independent group made up of journalists, activists, and academics, and it evaluates what Facebook does with content. Since January, the board's overturned 4 out of 5 content decisions by Facebook. And while the board agreed with Facebook's initial decision to suspend Trump, the ban isn't necessarily permanent because the board more or less kicked the ball back to Facebook for them to figure out when or if Trump can return and what exactly should happen with politicians and public figures on the platform.
Indefinite penalties of this sort do not pass the international or American smell test for clarity, consistency, and transparency.
That's Michael McConnell, co-chair of the board, speaking on Wednesday. And since Facebook is a private company, they can decide what types of content or speech to allow or reject. This case has big implications for the future of online speech, especially with more cases like these that will continue to arise around the world. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, host of What Next TBD from Slate, and I'm in for Tanzina Vega. We are breaking down Facebook and the former president and what this case means, and it's where we start today on The Takeaway. For more on this, we're joined now by Evelyn Dueck, a lecturer at Harvard Law School and affiliate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society. Evelyn, good to talk to you.
Great to be here.
And also Cecilia Kang, technology reporter at The New York Times and co-author of An Ugly Truth, Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. Cecilia, nice to talk to you as well.
Nice to be here, Lizzie.
Cecilia, I'm going to start with you. Just remind us why Facebook banned Donald Trump from its platform in the first place and how they justified that.
Right. So we have to go back to January 6th, the day of the Capitol riots, and there were 2 posts that former President Trump put on Facebook and Instagram. One was a video and one was a statement where he called the rioters great patriots and he again denied the results of the election. This is a very heated time. This was during the election, the Capitol riots. Facebook decided that those 2 posts violated their own internal rules against content that incites violence. And they took down the posts. And the day later, on January 7th, they actually blocked or banned Trump from his account. And said that until at least the inauguration, that he should not be allowed back onto either of those apps because of the company's concern over the peaceful transition of governments and that the president could further incite violence and disrupt that process.
Evelyn, Facebook's independent oversight board upheld the suspension, but kind of tossed it back at Facebook to make its own decision about Trump in 6 months. Can you explain what the board is supposed to be doing anyway and how you would describe what they did in this instance?
So the board's a really interesting and weird institution. It's something that Facebook set up all by itself to do, you know, exactly this kind of thing of reviewing really hard decisions that Facebook has to make or controversial decisions and be an independent check on otherwise what is basically Facebook's power to do whatever it wants. And in particular, Mark Zuckerberg's power to just sort of make these huge decisions, like to kick off the then sitting president of the United States from one of the most, you know, important ways in which he communicates with his followers. So yesterday, the board took this decision, and basically the only thing that it definitively said was, yes, on January 7, you did the right thing in removing the account. But as you said, it kind of kicked the ball back to Facebook on essentially every other question. It said, but you can't just indefinitely suspend him. What does indefinite even mean? That's not a fair thing to tell someone. It doesn't sort of comply with the way we think about giving people certainty in the law. And so it said, you know, you have 6 months to work out what to do now and to come up with a policy on how you might deal with this kind of situation in the future.
The board is this group of 20 people, journalists, academics, the former prime minister of Denmark, and they have, Cecilia, sort of given this power back to Mark Zuckerberg. Is this just something that Zuckerberg's going to have to make a call on?
Essentially, that's right. And it's the sort of great irony is that Mark Zuckerberg set up this oversight board. He conceived the idea a few years ago because he didn't want to have to make these kinds of big decisions. He said that Facebook should not have to make these kinds of big decisions. And you can imagine why, because it's enormously that there's such a huge responsibility. And also, you don't really win in many ways when you're held liable or responsible for these kinds of decisions, held responsible. So he set up the board saying, or he conceived of the board to have a third independent body. But let's be like clear. This is a third party body that he has analogized to like a Supreme Court type of system, or sort of board or panel. But this was conceived by Facebook. It was set up by Facebook. It is funded by Facebook, though, through a third party trust. The initial board members were selected by Facebook, and Facebook had a say on all the board members that were thereafter selected. So there's always been questions about independence. I think that the board itself points to a few things to show that it is independent, but what the board did yesterday, which was quite extraordinary, was they said, listen, you know, Facebook, you want us to make the final call on Trump. Trump has been a real problem for you throughout Trump's administration, as well as after his tenure. And the board said, you cannot shirk that responsibility. One quote that really stood out to me, they said, in applying a vague standardless penalty and then referring this case to the board to resolve, Facebook seeks to avoid its responsibilities. So the board is essentially saying, you can't ask us to make the final call when you don't have clear guidelines for how you made that call in the first place, this indefinite ban. So we're sending it back to you, which is exactly what Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook did not want to happen.
Evelyn, I think one thing that's really important here is that obviously we're talking about Donald Trump, but that this isn't just about Donald Trump, but really setting a standard for what Donald Trump, Bolsonaro, Narendra Modi, or any world leader or important person can say on Facebook.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. It's something that often gets lost in these conversations. You know, Donald Trump is the black hole to which all of our attention is attracted. But this is a really important decision to my mind, the most important part of this decision is for what it says, exactly as you said, for world leaders all around the world. And that's not just today. It's not just Bolsonaro or Duterte or Modi, as you're quite right to mention, but it's every world leader sort of from now into the future, as long as Facebook has this policy that it will write in the coming months. And, you know, as long as there's world leaders on Facebook, there will be world leaders who manipulate and use Facebook for nefarious ends. And we need to work out what to do with this problem.
Cecilia, in the U.S., there's been a pretty harsh conservative backlash. What do you think happens with that?
Yeah, I think this just further angers a lot of Republicans in particular about Facebook's handling of the former president. They point to this ban as evidence. And you know, to be sure, Twitter has permanently banned Trump as well. YouTube has indefinitely banned Trump from its site, though it says that he will come back on without any guidelines on when that might be, except to say that they will do so when it's safe to do so. So these bans on Trump, in the minds of many conservative lawmakers in the U.S., is evidence that there is an alleged anti-conservative bias by these companies and these platforms. They say that they favor more progressive or left-leaning lawmakers. So they point to this as censorship. in their mind. And so,
though we should note that studies have found no such bias.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this, but this is a battle cry that continues, and it's gotten louder. Yesterday, we heard a lot of lawmakers speak out. And I think the way you're going to see that play out is these lawmakers are going to really focus on the power of technology companies. And they are going to threaten, for example, antitrust action against these companies, saying that these social media platforms have too much power over speech. They should not be the gatekeepers of speech. So we need to look at the dominance and power that these companies hold and see whether they should be broken up or in any other way lessened in terms of their influence and dominance.
Evelyn, I want you to take apart this question of power and speech, because these are private companies. They can decide who says what on their platforms. They are not, you know, the government. They don't fall under First Amendment sort of rules in the same way. But they do have an extraordinary amount of power. I wonder if we have reached a point as a society where these platforms are too powerful and what to do with that.
Yeah, I think no one really knows what to do with that, to be honest. They're kind of this weird thing that we haven't really seen before. You're quite right to say they're not governments, and we shouldn't hold them to governmental standards in what speech they do or do not allow. And currently under the law, they have complete discretion to do what they want. But that feels like a very unsatisfactory situation, because they are really important forums, and they do dramatically influence politics, culture. So many things about modern life happen on Facebook and these other platforms. And so how do we think about that? You know, I think this sort of both sides of the aisle have different views at different times, depending on particular decisions as to whether they are just private companies and they should be allowed to do whatever they want, or whether they are too powerful and we need to rein them in so they can't make these decisions on such a whim. And I think, you know, the answer is, you know, we do need to think about that. Whether antitrust can solve this problem, honestly, I'm not sure that it does. I think that there may be very good independent reasons to take antitrust action. But to my mind, Twitter is a good example of why that's not going to solve our problems. Twitter is a pretty small company in many respects. I don't really know how you would split up Twitter, but it really is still extremely important, the decisions that it makes.
Cecilia, quickly, are we back here 6 months from now having this conversation again?
Oh, yeah. I'm going to put it on my calendar, Lizzie. We're going to be talking exactly about this. This is Facebook has 6 months to make its own decision on Trump and to justify and explain why it did so, and explain how it deals with political speech and political leaders on its platform. And we're going to be hashing out the same sort of questions in many ways. And it'll be a real question as to what the board's future is at that point going forward.
Cecilia Kang is a tech reporter for The New York Times and co-author of An Ugly Truth, Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. And Evelyn Duak is a lecturer at Harvard Law School. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks so much.
And hey, make sure you go check out my day job podcast, Slate's What Next TBD, because we're talking about Facebook and how this decision around Trump might actually change the way you and I use the platform as well. Last summer, Epic Games, the maker of the wildly popular game Fortnite, stopped paying the 30% fee to Apple on the App Store and created a way for users to bypass the App Store's payment system. Apple then kicked Epic off the App Store, claiming that this violated their guidelines. Now, Epic is suing Apple for antitrust violations in a case that started on Monday and is expected to play out over the next few weeks. Here to tell us about what's at stake in this case and how it's likely to affect consumers is Addie Robertson, a senior reporter at The Verge who covers tech and policy. Addie, welcome to the show.
Hi.
You've been following this case pretty closely. Can you lay out kind of the big arguments on both sides?
Yeah. So on Epic's side, the argument is that Apple has a monopoly over basically iOS, which is this thriving ecosystem with huge numbers of devices. And because of this, it can force developers to run through its App Store, which has, it's arguing, stringent requirements, but doesn't really provide that much benefit. And that extends to in-app purchases, which are sort of their own market distinct from the larger app market, and take a 30% for big companies, and after this lawsuit, a 15% cut for smaller apps. And this, they're arguing, I mean, outside Epic, this is widely called the Apple tax. And they want either the judge to say that this in-app purchase processing system is specifically a monopoly and they should be able to use their own payment processing system. And their bigger ask is that Apple should have to let them let people load independent app stores like the Epic Game Store, which Epic is sort of trying to get off the ground. It's losing a lot of money right now, but they're hoping that it becomes a big part of their business later. So that's Epic's side of the lawsuit. Apple's side is that, in their words, this is an assault on the iPhone. That their argument is that the reason people choose the iPhone over something like Android is that it offers this more secure, more private, more kind of curated and directed experience. And that that only happens because Apple can control exactly what goes on the App Store. That that means that people are safer from malware, that they can always expect a consistent experience. Unlike what Epic is saying, they say, look, we actually spend a lot of time making sure that what happens on the App Store is all on the up and up. So this is now going to court, and it's delving into a really wide array of issues, from developing what it takes to develop a web app versus an app for the App Store, just what Apple's process for getting apps into the store looks like, and for a while, the definition of a game.
You know, this is an antitrust case, and I think for those of us who may have learned the broad outlines of antitrust in school, you think about something like Standard Oil, which was the great big company that controlled all, you know, U.S. oil. This is a very different thing when you talk about applying antitrust rules to technology. How does that work?
So a slightly more recent comparison is the big antitrust case against Microsoft at the turn of the 21st century, where a lot of the big sort of thing that has changed is that a lot of products are free now, or freemium, that say Fortnite is a thing that you don't really pay for when you start the game. And that also there's this big sort of debate over right now, the sort of standard for a monopoly that's harmful is that there's some kind of harm for consumers, which is what there's a lot of time dedicated to proving in court. And that's also come up a lot as a larger debate. But right now, the big argument is Apple is a monopoly. It is a monopoly specifically over the iOS ecosystem that it runs, and that it is suppressing competitors and it's causing harm to consumers because it's running that store poorly. This is, just to be clear, kind of controversial, the idea that you have a monopoly over a single product that you own. There is precedent for it, but it's a little bit of an uphill battle for Epic.
What's at stake for Apple here? What's their worst case scenario?
Their worst case scenario is that Apple has to work like Android, that you should be able to sideload an app onto your iPhone the same way that you can just download something and put it on your Android phone. That right now you can do that, but it's very difficult. You have to jailbreak your phone. Apple very strongly discourages it. So Apple loses control of its ecosystem. And even in the less extreme scenario that Apple doesn't get to, say, charge for in-app purchases anymore, that's a huge part of its revenue. A lot of apps, if you think about the number of big apps that are subscription-based, if suddenly Apple loses all of the people who sign up through iOS, and that 30% or 15% cut that they give, that's a really huge hit to Apple's business model.
You know, one of the things I find interesting is how this case dovetails with Apple's marketing. Apple has really said, we are the company that provides the best privacy protections for users, that every app on our App Store is up to our standards. It feels to me like this case, separate and apart from the question with Epic, also kind of strikes at the heart of how Apple sells itself.
Yeah, which is a big part of what this trial is going to be, both in the court and the court of public opinion. So on Apple's side, it's pointing out, look, we have this gigantic review apparatus, we can make sure that people have a great experience. And then Epic's going to be citing, it hasn't really come up in the trial yet, but it's going to be calling up executives to talk about what the review process looks like. It's got some testimony from earlier that there's a pretty great quote that the App Store review process is like the pretty lady who's meeting you at the airport with a lei rather than an actual security guard, or that it's like bringing a butter knife to a gunfight. So those quotes are probably going to come up in court, and there's going to be a very large debate over the whole security process. Conversely, we've had a little bit of discussion about how it's actually not necessarily that hard for developers to create some kind of system by which people can pay outside, that you can open up Safari and go to a website and pay a lower price for some apps than if you just go through the App Store. And Apple's arguing that, look, okay, we obviously have a payment system that's an alternative, just go to Safari.
Let's talk about what it means for a company to get kicked off the App Store.
Yeah. So right now, if you want to have an app on the store, a native app, which is the sort of thing that you install and it stays on your phone, as opposed to a web app, which you'd open as a web page, you submit a product for review to Apple, and then it reviews it against its developer guidelines, and then you put it on the store. And then after that, you have to use certain Apple processes, like you have to enable Apple sign-ins under certain circumstances, and you have to use a special system for processing payments through it that gives it a cut. And then Apple is going to review all the product changes after that, and it might give people feedback. The way that Epic got its payment processing system on the store was through something called a hotfix, which was a sort of much smaller and less strictly examined change. And they kind of snuck it in, a thing that Apple's made a really big deal out of at the trial, that they added this code and then they had a switch on their servers that they flipped a while later and turned on the system. Something that Apple has called dishonest and lacking integrity and compared to cheating in Fortnite.
You know, this case is sort of one plank in a larger antitrust push against Apple. How would you describe the other kind of aspects of what Apple does that people and regulators take issue with?
So a lot of the fight over Apple is about the App Store, and it's about sort of varying aspects of it. There are a bunch of other app makers that are mad at Apple, and some of them have also appeared in this trial. Just the day before the trial started, the EU regulators brought a complaint on behalf of Spotify, which is complaining specifically about in-app purchase prices in the music space. So there's this whole array of apps that's outside Fortnite and gaming, where there are complaints about in-app purchases or them not being able to offer specific features because they go against the developer guidelines, or people not being able to get things like alternative stores. And that's come up in Congress because there's this really large push to regulate what they call big tech, which is basically Apple, Google, Facebook, and Amazon. And there are very different antitrust cases against all of them, but there has been a really big report. They're considering overhauling the rule. They're especially considering examining the consumer harm model. And if Epic loses this case, there is a reasonable chance that Congress is able to spin that into, look, there was a really strong case and it didn't go anywhere. Antitrust law is broken.
I think a lot of the details of this case or what different regulators are doing can be confusing for consumers. But at the end of the day, a lot of the law underpinning this is about consumer harm. So how could the outcome of this case affect people who use the App Store or people who play Fortnite?
So the really obvious thing is that if Epic wins this case, Fortnite goes back on the App Store, and either goes back on the App Store or goes back on the iPhone through some other method. And
11-year-olds across the U.S. will be delighted.
Yes, but they have to pretend they're 13 because that's the minimum age for Fortnite. So that's the really obvious proximate conclusion. If Apple really loses big, then you can expect a pretty different model for the iPhone, that you can install apps in a different way, and that it's maybe easier for you to get lower prices for specific apps if they offer them without the 30% cut, without doing something like going through the website. So that's maybe a little bit easier. If you really like the App Store model and you sort of like that the iPhone is this very curated experience, then you might not be as happy. And in a larger sense, this could have a sort of effect on future cases with anything that's a sort of locked down store. So if there's any other device that works too much like the App Store model, then that could change as well. It's not necessarily clear what those would be. Apple's arguing that pretty much any game console is a monopoly under Epic's claims. So you would have to completely change how, like, the Nintendo Switch and the PlayStation and the Xbox work. But that's not necessarily clear. That's a thing that they're arguing about in court.
Do you think it's appropriate to look at this case in the context of sort of the broader backlash against big tech, you know, on behalf of consumers or also lawmakers? Or is it a separate thing with two companies that are competing?
It's definitely part of a very long string of lawsuits by developers against Apple. There was a big class action suit that went to the Supreme Court a couple of years ago from developers who were complaining about Apple's practices. And it's arguably Epic was able to bring this lawsuit because it could muster a lot of public participation, that it could, partly because Fortnite's super popular. They prepared this 1980 Fortnite commercial after they filed the suit that was trying to sort of muster support. But also that it's happening during a period where they know that they're going to get a lot of people saying this is part of a larger movement, that there are a lot of developers that they can muster to their side, that there are a lot of Congress people who are potentially looking at this case. And that even if Apple wins, there's going to be a really hard look at the Apple tax.
Addie Robertson is a senior reporter at The Verge who covers tech and policy. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
Have you ever had an encounter with someone that left you feeling a little braver?
I remember getting in a car and just driving, and it was just for curiosity's sake. That freedom led to, like, a lot of rediscoveries. Just for life, things became colorful again.
Join me, Helga Davis, for conversations with artists and thinkers who share my passion for living fearlessly. It's a new season of Helga. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
In recent years, comedian Joel Kim Booster has been one of the most exciting figures in the stand-up comedy scene. He's performed sets on late-night shows, including The Late Late Show with James Corden and on Conan.
And the reason I have this very goofy name is, yes, I was adopted by a nice white Midwestern couple in the mid-80s, like many Korean babies were. Korea in the mid-80s, if you were around, you probably remember, it was the only country that would fly a baby to the U.S. and you didn't have to go and pick it up. So it was very much the Grubhub of babies back then. It was delivered by a very grumpy man on a bike. Forgot my mom's Pepsi, wouldn't go back for it. It was a disaster.
During the pandemic, Joel's been able to stay busy writing for shows including Netflix's Big Mouth and co-hosting the podcast Urgent Care. Now, after more than a year without indoor comedy sets, he's scheduled to perform for a crowd again later this month in LA.
I feel really, really excited to get back on that horse. I'm a little nervous. I feel a little guilty as well. There's like this guilt creeping in where I'm like, I feel bad for the people who are paying real money to watch me get good at this again, because I have no idea. I mean, it's been so long since I've done an hour of stand-up comedy sustained. So it'll be really interesting to see how it goes.
When I talked to Joel over Zoom this week, he told me he's feeling a little rusty, but also hopeful about getting back to the style of comedy he really loves.
I've done a few outdoor shows that have been more shorter sets, like 10, 15 minutes, that sort of thing. And it is akin to riding a bike. You know, the muscle memory is there. I remember most of my jokes. There is just a little bit of awkwardness. I think that everybody in the world is feeling at parties in terms of interacting with other people, tenfold interacting with a group of people in an audience. So there is just a little bit of a barrier there that I'm trying to get over. But I'm mostly just really excited because this is what I do. And I'm a pretty old school stand-up comedian in that I didn't spend a lot of time online making content over the pandemic. Stand-up is what I do. And so I've really, really, really missed it. And I'm going to milk it and enjoy it for, you know, every moment that I can.
Yeah, you told Vulture that stand-up was the only thing you're really good at. We can dispute that, but I guess, what is it about stand-up that is so different? Like, do you feed off of the energy of a live audience, or it just Zoom just doesn't work for it?
It's definitely that. I mean, it's definitely the interplay with the audience is a huge part of it for me. I mean, that's how I write as well. I'm not a comedian who sits down and like writes, like, you know, I haven't been writing a ton of jokes about the pandemic, mostly because I need the interplay with the audience to sort of, it's a conversation for me, you know, like when I write new jokes, I sort of start with a premise and then go out and work it out live on stage in front of an audience. And without that audience to work it out, it's really hard for me to land on what the joke even is, because it's conversation for me. I think for me, stand-up is like the ultimate meritocracy in the arts. You know, there is a lot of nonsense that goes on, I think, in writing and in acting, a lot of politics at play. Not always the best person gets the part, or not always the best writer gets the best spot in the room. There's a lot of stuff that goes into it. Whereas with stand-up, I mean, if they're laughing in the moment, you know that you're doing well. And there's no feeling like, there's no replicable feeling like that anywhere else in the arts, at least that I've experienced.
I talked to Melissa Villaseñor, and she was saying that she doesn't actually want to try out pandemic-related material. Yeah. Like, are you moving away from the pandemic and what you're doing? Are you leaning into it? How does that work?
I have one little baby pandemic joke that I've been doing, just sort of, it feels sort of necessary to address the elephant in the room, at least up top. But from then on, I'm sort of moving away from it and framing everything as though the world is normal again, because I think that's what people are craving. I don't think people want to be in the headspace of talking about, you know, the weirdness of wearing masks. You know, I think people want to look forward and they want to look back. They want to talk about dating again, because that's what, you know, they just want to talk about bad sex and dating and everything in between.
Do you feel responsibility for that? Like, I don't know, it feels kind of heavy.
What do you mean responsibility? Like
to make people happy right now?
Yeah, I mean, that is it's sort of a two-way street, right? Like I'm doing this because it makes me really happy, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm going back out on stage because it makes me really happy, and I know that in part those people are coming out because they want to be really, really happy. And so we're sort of, I don't know, it's like a mutual agreement between the two of us that we're going to have a good time on that while I'm on stage. And as long as that agreement holds up, I think that we both get what we want out of it.
I'm not going to ask you to, you know, plagiarize your act, but I wonder if there are bits you're particularly excited about trying out.
There's a lot of bits that I'm a really interactive comedian. I really love to interact with the audience and do a lot of crowd work. And that's the kind of stuff that I'm really excited to get back into to trying, you know, and interrogating relationships is a really big part of my set. You know, finding couples and figuring out the intricacies of their relationship and what makes them tick and work and not work and things like that. And I have a lot of jokes that hinge on those interactions. And so I'm really, really excited to figure out how to do that in a socially distant way now.
Yeah, I was gonna say, is your audience gonna be masked? Like, will you be able to read them in that way?
The audiences that I've been performing for even outside have been masked. So it is a little bit more of a challenge. There's definitely more to navigate there. But I think like body language goes a long way and, you know, eye contact and things like that. Like I can get through, I can figure it out with the mask on.
How do you practice?
How do I practice?
Yeah.
I mean, normally I practice by doing, you know, shows in the back of the bar on the east side of LA on the weeknights. You know, that's normally how I practice. I have no practice. I have no outlet for practice at this point. Like Zoom shows don't cut it. Zoom shows are a completely different muscle. It's a completely different skill set than real stand-up comedy. So I'm kind of going in after a year. It's like running a marathon after not running for a year and some change. So it'll be a real interesting challenge to see how I make it through this hour. Right now, I've just been watching old tapes of myself. That's sort of the intermediary for me.
You're a big tweeter too. Like
I am a big tweeter. I'm not as big, prolific as I was before the pandemic though, because I just have less to say right now because my life feels so much smaller. But I, you know, as the world opens up and as I have more, you know, experience out in the world, I think I'll have more to say.
Are there specific things that will make you feel safe in a club, you think, going in? Or like when you're performing, do you just put everything else out of your mind?
Yeah, I'm not really thinking about personal safety while I'm performing, I guess. I'm like, there is something, I don't know, you know, you just sort of jump and, while you're up there, it is sort of this like zone of confidence that you just have to have in order to make it through the set. And so I'm, you know, I know that things will be clean. The mic will be clean, sanitized. Everyone will be in masks except for me. I'll be, you know, socially distant, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not super nervous about it, but I'm mostly just excited to get back indoors and see how it feels.
LA has this very special comedy community and places that are kind of legendary where comics of all different kind of stripes come and work their stuff out. I wonder what that has been like for you to see some of these venues closed for so long.
I mean, it's been really tough. It's been really, really hard to see like places like the Virgil go dark for me. I mean, that's one of my like favorite places to perform in LA. And it feels like a loss of a home almost, you know, like a creative home. And so we all feel, I think, a little unmoored, you know, like we've been doing these. I just did a show in the back of a pickup truck in a backyard, and it's not exactly the same. It doesn't have the same history. It doesn't have the same vibe as the home clubs that we're all used to performing at. So we all feel a little unmoored right now, I think.
Have you sketched out a plan for the coming months? Do you think you're going to go on tour, or are you kind of starting gradually?
Starting gradually, I have a few show dates in, like, I know in June I'll be in Arlington, Virginia, and I'm going to be in New York for most of the summer, and I'm doing a sort of residency in New York where I'll be, you know, doing an hour every week or so in New York, which will be really exciting. But for now, it's just sort of like figuring out where places are open and where I can get the reps in.
Joel Kim Booster is a comedian who's written for shows including Big Mouth and the other two. He's also got a podcast called Urgent Care. Joel, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
For many people, pregnancy and childbirth are already incredibly stressful. But during a once-in-a-generation pandemic, it certainly raises that stress level, especially since pregnant people have a higher chance of developing more severe cases of the coronavirus. I know this both as a journalist and as someone who had a kid during the pandemic. I gave birth in July, and my son is now 10 months old. And for a lot of us, the news of vaccines being distributed felt like such a weight being lifted. But for some pregnant people, it also raised questions as to what that could mean for their health and the health of their fetus. A silver lining for many of us is that some studies have shown that vaccinated pregnant people are able to pass antibodies on to their babies. Today in the U.S., more than 100,000 pregnant people have been vaccinated. Joining me now to help break all of this down is Dr. Catherine Gray, associate obstetrician at Brigham and Women's Hospital and assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Gray, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Let's lay out the official CDC guidance when it comes to people who are pregnant or breastfeeding getting the COVID-19 vaccine.
So this has been evolving over time as more evidence has come out, but the basic party line has still been that this is a discussion between the provider and the patient about the vaccine, so weighing the risks and the benefits. So thankfully, with time since the vaccine has come out, we have found that so far, it looks like the COVID vaccines are safe in pregnancy. So through their CDC pregnancy registry, there's been no safety signals. So no increased rate of miscarriage, no increased rate of preterm birth or any other complications that have been detected. And through many studies that have come out now, including ours, we have seen that pregnant women respond similarly as non-pregnant women to the vaccine. So they mount a good antibody response, and they also are able to pass antibodies through the placenta to the baby and through their breast milk. And so when discussing it, like you mentioned, pregnant patients are at increased risk of getting severe COVID, and they have the ability to be protected themselves and to protect their neonates by getting the vaccine. So those are points that we discuss with patients.
What kind of questions do your patients ask you, and what do you tell them?
You know, there's been a lot of concern about the safety piece. So what do we know about safety? Could there be things that we haven't been able to detect because this is so new? So, you know, people are concerned about the lack of time since the vaccine has been available. They want to know what degree of protection it will have for them. You know, if they've had COVID before, should they get the vaccine or are they already protected? And they're very concerned about what level of protection their baby will have if they get vaccinated and breastfeed, which we're still, you know, working on getting data on. So we think there should be some protection from pregnant patients being vaccinated to their neonates, but we don't know how much yet. So patients really want to know that.
In terms of the research, what does it tell us so far about how these vaccines sort of interact with fetal development?
Well, we don't know of any adverse effects on fetal development. You know, from what we know about other vaccines, we know that vaccines over time, all the ones we have studied, are very safe in pregnancy. And actually, some vaccines are
recommended,
right? Yep. So pertussis, or the whooping cough vaccine, is recommended at 28 weeks of pregnancy, and that's because moms generate antibodies that do pass to the baby and prevent very young infants from getting whooping cough, and it's really important. Same with influenza. We know pregnant women get sicker from influenza than non-pregnant individuals, and so it's recommended if you are pregnant during the flu season to get the flu vaccine.
Dr. Gray, have there been trials that focus specifically on how pregnant people react to these vaccines?
The only clinical trial that is being done that I'm aware of right now in the United States is the Pfizer vaccine, and that started at the end of February. So they're gathering data on safety and effectiveness of the vaccine in pregnant patients. Then there's just the registry about you know, safety, and then many studies coming out of academic centers that are looking at, you know, side effects from the vaccine in pregnant patients and efficacy.
You know, one of the things that I find completely fascinating and did when I was pregnant and then when I had a newborn is how immunity works between mother and baby. And I'd love for you to explain how immunity and antibodies from vaccines are passed on to babies.
Sure. So I think there's two things to think about. One is how antibodies are passed during pregnancy from mom to the fetus, and then how antibodies are passed during breastfeeding from mom to the baby. So during pregnancy, when a mother receives a vaccine, the pregnant individual mounts an immune response. So mom generates antibodies. And then certain types of those antibodies, which we refer to as IgGs, can pass through the placenta into the baby's blood and provide what we call passive immunity. So when the baby is born, those antibodies from mom stay in the baby's blood for several months and help provide protection. In breastfeeding, there's antibodies that are also secreted in the breast milk from mom, and those obviously the baby ingests into the GI tract, and we know those provide some protection within the GI tract. And what other immune responses those antibodies might provoke in the infant are a subject of great investigation and interest, and I think we don't have a full understanding of the degree of protection the breast milk and breastfeeding piece provides specifically.
Yeah, you're leading me toward my next question, which is what my group chats with other moms are aflame with, which is, if I am vaccinated and breastfeeding, am I passing some immunity onto my kid?
Yeah, I mean, we think that there is there should be some protective effect. How much is just unknown at this point, and I wish we could answer that. You know, we've had many inquiries about from moms asking if they give their other older children breast milk, will they be able to confer some protection to those older children? And you know, we just don't know the degree of protection that might provide. And I emphasize that regardless of vaccination of the mom during pregnancy or breastfeeding, that as soon as you know, vaccines are available to younger children and all age groups, that they should still pursue vaccination.
One thing that I think people who have not been pregnant or aren't pregnant may not have thought about a lot is how little information there can be on drugs in general and how they affect pregnant people, because doing those trials are hard. Can you explain kind of the science and the ethics behind doing drug and vaccine research on pregnant people?
Yeah, this is a great area of controversy and a great area of need. And I recently wrote an editorial sort of discussing this topic. But, you know, when we leave pregnant patients out of trials on medications, it means that we don't have any evidence of how those drugs work during pregnancy when we know the metabolism and pharmacology is very different of medications than in non-pregnant individuals. So when we don't include women in trials, then we don't know how drugs behave in pregnancy. And that poses a real problem, because then the only data we have is, you know, people who received the drug during pregnancy, and we have to wait a long time to, you know, gather enough retrospective data to try to take a look at that. And inherently, that data is different and, you know, confounded in a way that prospective clinical trials are not. So we've really limited the ability of pregnant patients to make decisions about medications and other therapies and vaccines when we exclude them from trials. But you're right that it does cost a lot of money, and you specifically have to recruit pregnant populations. And, you know, there are concerns about fetal development and effects of medication on fetal development, some more than others. And so it's a delicate balance between, you know, protection and, you know, protection by exclusion isn't always the best, right? So with the COVID-19 vaccine, you know, when it was first came out, there were about 35,000 healthcare workers in the United States who were pregnant, who were immediately eligible for the vaccine, and there was no data. Just left a lot of people without knowing what to do.
What do you think causes that? Is it sexism? Is it cautiousness? What is it?
Well, one, I mean, over time, we haven't devoted as many resources towards women's health and pregnancy as we have other areas of research. But number two, there's this concern for fetal development over the concern for women's health, or this delicate balance. And so I think people are hesitant and nervous about, you know, potential adverse outcomes for pregnant patients. So I think it's tricky to figure out, you know, how one should approach this.
There's also been some fear-mongering around vaccines and the effects on fertility. For people who are thinking about becoming pregnant, what does the data say about the effects of these vaccines on fertility?
There's no evidence that the COVID-19 vaccines affect fertility. And this is, you know, a rampant rumor that really took off in, you know, social media, especially. And I think it's really unfortunate because we've scared a lot of individuals away from being vaccinated. And there is not any evidence that or, you know, even plausible biologic pathways by which the vaccine could cause infertility. So I would just tell people that, you know, this isn't based on any evidence that we know of.
Dr. Catherine Gray is an associate obstetrician at Brigham and Women's Hospital and assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, everyone, that's Thursday's show. Happy to be with you today. And I'll be back with you for one more day tomorrow, filling in for Tanzina. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Lizzie O'Reilly. And if you want to learn more about Facebook's Supreme Court, and especially how this decision might change the way you and I use Facebook in the future, check out my podcast, What Next TBD from Slate, wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.